Today is Wednesday, June 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, a preview of the first round of Democratic presidential candidate debates that are scheduled to kick off this evening in Miami, Florida. Also, Palestinians are protesting an economic initiative being launched by the White House to generate $50 billion in investments in the Palestinian territories and neighboring Arab states.
My direct message to the Palestinian people is that despite what those who have let you down in the past tell you, President Trump and America have not given up on you.
Those stories and more just ahead. It is more than 16 months until the next U.S. presidential election in late 2020, but 20 Democratic presidential contenders are set to debate each other tonight and tomorrow. The debates give Democratic voters a look at those who are vying to become the party's nominee to try and oust Republican President Donald Trump. The unwieldy field of candidates, in addition to six others who did not meet the Democratic National Committee's minimal standards to merit a spot in the debates, all argue that they have a chance to unseat Trump after a single term in the White House. Now, to unpack everything and to get a preview of the Democratic debates, I'm joined on the phone from Miami, Florida, by VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Hello, Catherine.
Hello.
So we have 20 candidates, 2 days. Who exactly is debating and when?
Well, in the first night of debates, which we have happening in just a few hours here in Miami, the prime spot for tonight's debate belongs to Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts. Now, I was at a town hall meeting of hers here in Miami last night, and there was a lot of excitement on the ground here from Florida voters. The Florida voters here told me that they really like that Elizabeth Warren has a, quote, plan for everything. That's kind of her catchphrase among voters. I've got a plan for that. That really seemed to resonate with the voters here, and I'm sure she'll be bringing that up in the debate tonight.
What about some of the other front leaders in the Democratic pool, like Bernie Sanders?
Right. So the second night of debates is packed with some of those front runners like Bernie Sanders. And of course, we have to talk about Joe Biden, who is leading that crowded field right now. This is really his debate to lose. And what we know about debates so far is that you really can't mess up in a debate because then it stands out as that moment that everybody goes back to and remembers. That's how you lose a debate. It's really not a matter of winning with this crowded of the field.
Now, as we mentioned, we have 20 candidates who are debating tonight and tomorrow, six that didn't make the cut. But when it's spread over 2 days, what exactly do we know about the format, about what's going to take place each night?
So with this number of candidates, we know that they need to get in their message quickly, that they're being limited to very short specific answers, limited rebuttals. So they're going to have to really rein themselves in. We're talking about a lot of people who currently serve in the U.S. Congress and are used to going onto the floor of the U.S. Congress and speaking for as long as they like. They are really going to have to work with their staff to cut down their message and get it into a summary that will really resonate with voters on television.
Are you getting a sense as to where the candidates may want to be in terms of debating tonight versus tomorrow? Because if you're going, I mean, when I think about sports or giving speeches in competitions, going later on and seeing how others perform kind of maybe puts me in a better position. Are the candidates thinking that way?
You know, I can see how that sports analogy would work, but there's also an argument that Elizabeth Warren, by being the only high-profile contender in tonight's debate, the very first night of debate, she kind of has this opportunity to get out ahead of the pack by standing out on that debate stage, by really not having any other people who can take her down in a serious way. It's almost like giving her an uninterrupted period of time to make her case to American voters.
Now, we have mentioned that six candidates didn't make the cut. Is there a way for them to perhaps get involved in debates further down the line?
Absolutely. So if they meet that criteria, they can make those next upcoming debates. We really are not short on debates. We have more coming up in July, more coming up in September. And like you said, this is a 16-month-long process. We are still very, very early in the presidential election process here in the United States.
Catherine Gibsons covers the congressional beat for VOA here in Washington. She is in Miami for the first debates on the Democratic ticket. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
A photograph of a man and his 23-month-old daughter found face down in shallow water along the bank of the Rio Grande in Texas has highlighted the perils faced by mostly Central American migrants fleeing violence and poverty and hoping for asylum in the United States. The photograph that has been distributed of the discovery of their bodies on Monday was captured by journalist Julia Leduc and was published by the Mexican newspaper La Jornada. Leduc reports that Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez was frustrated because his family from El Salvador was unable to present themselves to U.S. authorities and request asylum, and then swam across the river on Sunday with his daughter, Valeria. He set her on the U.S. bank of the river and then started back for his wife, Tania Vanessa Alvaros. But seeing him move away, the young girl threw herself into the water. Martinez returned and grabbed Valeria, but the current swept them both away. U.S. officials have recorded 283 migrant deaths last year, but so far the toll this year has not been released. Palestinians are protesting an economic initiative being launched by the White House to generate $50 billion in investments in Palestinian territories and neighboring Arab states. The initiative, unveiled at a conference in Bahrain Tuesday, is part of a U.S. Middle East peace plan heralded by U.S. President Donald Trump as the deal of the century. But Palestinians insist that an economic vision cannot happen without a political settlement. White House correspondent Patsy Warakoswara has this report.
Palestinians clashed with Israeli forces and burned effigies of U.S. President Donald Trump as they protested against his administration's Peace to Prosperity economic plan. The initiative sets out an ambitious goal of $50 billion of investment in the Palestinian territories and three neighboring Arab states. It's the economic component of a Middle East peace plan called the Deal of the Century by President Trump, spearheaded by his son-in-law, White House advisor Jared Kushner.
My direct message to the Palestinian people is that despite what those who have let you down in the past tell you, President Trump and America have not given up on you.
The plan was unveiled Tuesday at a conference in Manama, Bahrain, with neither Palestinian nor Israeli officials attending. Proposed funding would come mainly from the Persian Gulf countries through grants and private equity sources. It's unclear how much, if any, funding the U.S. will provide.
We have to get economic support because the Palestinians don't have money. And we have to help the Palestinians with some money because they don't have it. And one of the groups that you get are some of those countries in the Middle East that do have money. So they're going to play a role in the peace plan.
Some observers called it dead on arrival.
You know, you have all of these goodies that are supposedly out there for funding, and Israelis aren't showing up, Palestinians aren't showing up, and no one with money is going to be putting it down at that conference.
Palestinians reject the plan because it does not address their demands for statehood, address the status of Jerusalem, and the fate of refugees.
Only when there is a political solution on the basis of international law and the two-state vision will we welcome all those who wish to help us, in Manama or anywhere else.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he is open to the plan.
And I cannot understand how the Palestinians, before they even heard the plan, rejected outright. That's not the way to proceed.
Many of the projects in the plan depend on an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. But U.S. officials are not releasing the political component of the plan until November, after Israeli elections and a new government is formed. Some called it a serious miscalculation.
If we don't know where Palestinian land is, we don't know where the borders are, then none of these projects are executable, and they're all sort of pipe dreams that the White House is putting out there without any idea of how they're going to actually move them forward.
The lack of Palestinian and Israeli involvement in the conference highlighted the Trump administration's difficulty to jumpstart long-stalled peace efforts. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Here are some other major stories from around the globe. Former special counsel Robert Mueller has agreed to provide open testimony before the U.S. House Judiciary Committee and the House Intelligence Committee next month. Authorities in Pakistan say three suicide bombers assaulted a regional police headquarters in a southwestern district Wednesday, triggering a firefight that killed a security officer and the assailants. The United States has condemned efforts by China at the UN Human Rights Council to justify its incarceration of a reported million Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities in re-education camps in Xinjiang province. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and, of course, on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Research over the past few years has provided evidence that music education can help a child's brain to grow and to mature quickly. A new study by researchers at Canada's University of Manitoba suggests students enrolled in high school music courses, regardless of factors such as their socioeconomic background or ethnicity, scored higher in math, science, and English exams than students not involved with music education. The study proposes that children who were taught to play a musical instrument in primary school and continued to play in secondary school were also found to be one academic year ahead of their non-musical colleagues in math, science, and English skills. The study authors found that students studying instrumental music did better academically than those who studied vocal music. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said today that he hopes the United States and China will resolve their trade war through constructive dialogue when they meet at a gathering of leaders from the group of 20 major economies. Abe spoke at a news conference ahead of this week's summit in Osaka, Japan. He said he wants the G20 to deliver a strong message on issues such as the promotion of free trade, innovation-driven global growth, and rulemaking for the digital economy.
このサミットにおいては、違いを強調するのではなくてですね、
Abe said that at this G20, he doesn't want to highlight differences of opinions. He wants to persistently identify common points and find common ground to reach a solution. The two-day G20 summit begins on Friday. President Trump and China's Xi Jinping, their president, are expected to meet separately on the sidelines. NATO has urged Russia on Wednesday to save a treaty that keeps land-based nuclear warheads out of Europe or face a more determined alliance response before an August 2nd deadline. VOA's Philip Alexio has that story.
Ahead of a defense minister's meeting in Brussels, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that time is running out to save the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF.
These new missiles, the new Russian missiles, they violate the INF Treaty, which has been a cornerstone for arms control for decades, and that's the reason why it is so extremely serious that Russia is deploying new missiles in clear violation of this treaty, putting the whole treaty in jeopardy.
Stoltenberg said the alliance would have to respond if Russia does not change its position, adding that so far there's no sign from Moscow indicating a possible change.
We will continue to call on them to respect the treaty. We're also planning a meeting of the NATO-Russia Council in the near future to be able to address this issue directly with Russia once again. If they don't come back into compliance, then we need to respond.
Stoltenberg said NATO is preparing, discussing, and considering different measures, but will continue to call on Russia to save the treaty. The RIA news agency reports that Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said that Moscow will respond in kind to any steps NATO takes over Russia's decision to suspend the treaty. Asked about tensions between the U.S. and Iran, Stoltenberg said that Washington's call for negotiations is key to reducing tensions in the region and avoid a dangerous situation.
We need to avoid escalation. We need to avoid miscalculations in the Gulf, in the region, because we have seen that it is important to avoid us moving into a situation that can become even more dangerous and more difficult than the situation we see today.
Commenting on the peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban on the agenda for the ministerial meeting, Stoltenberg said, "We are closer to a peace deal now than we have ever been before." Philip Alexio, VOA News.
The United Nations Political Affairs Chief Rosemary DiCarlo today told the Security Council, the United Nations, that U.S. decisions to end waivers allowing some countries to import Iranian oil may impede implementation of the Iran nuclear deal. She also said Iran's announcement that it will take steps to reduce compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal also endangers it. The Security Council meets as top U.S. and Iranian officials continue to fire verbal shots at one another. U.S. President Donald Trump said in an interview he does not want a war with Iran, but that, quote, "We are in a very strong position if something should happen," end quote. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said on Wednesday and called the U.S. the world's most vicious regime. Days after being targeted with fresh U.S. sanctions, Khamenei said the U.S. deceives other nations when it engages in negotiations. Trump has called the new sanctions a proportionate response to the downing of an unmanned U.S. military aircraft. Washington says the drone was in international airspace near the Strait of Hormuz, and Iran claims it was in its airspace. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, how long can a head of state maintain effective leadership? Some African leaders are forced out of office, while others respect the political process. The politics of transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Australians are increasingly suspicious about China and worry about the potential for foreign interference in their democracy. That's according to a new survey from a major foreign policy think tank. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Lowy Institute poll suggests many Australians believe their economy is too dependent on China and there's too much investment from Beijing. Attitudes towards the Chinese appear to have hardened in the past 12 months because of Beijing's territorial claims in the South China Sea, concern over Chinese involvement in Australia's telecommunications network, and allegations of cyber attacks and interference in domestic politics. According to the survey, Australians' trust in China to be a responsible global power is at its lowest since the annual poll began 15 years ago. Natasha Kassam is a research fellow at the Sydney-based Lowy Institute.
Only 32% of Australians now trust China to act responsibly in the world, and that's 20 points down from 2018, which is really significant. And across the Lowy Institute poll, we can see on a number of different indicators growing concern about Australia's relationship with China.
Even as concerns about China appear to mount, the poll hasn't shown a surge in support for the United States, Australia's long-term military ally. Only a quarter of respondents say they had confidence in US President Donald Trump. Australia is a wealthy middle power with close ties to Asia, particularly Japan and Singapore. It's a former British colony and retains a strong relationship with Britain. Its most valuable security alliance is with the United States, while it's relied on China, its biggest trading partner, for its recent prosperity. juggling and negotiating the complexities of these different and diverse diplomatic ties are perennial challenges for Canberra. The poll is conducted for the Lowy Institute by a social research organisation. It quizzed more than 2,000 Australians in mid to late March. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A United Nations investigator says the rise of the private surveillance industry and the targeting of individuals by digital surveillance technology is undermining freedom of expression and puts the many lives at risk. The UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, David Kaye, submitted this report to the UN Human Rights Council today. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the Council in Geneva.
UN investigator David Kaye does not condemn all surveillance activities. He recognizes that governments may have a valid and critical need to use surveillance technology to confront criminal activity such as terrorism. He says governments should be able to acquire and use the technology to protect their citizens. But he says he finds the transfer of private digital surveillance technology to governments that use it as a tool of repression very worrisome.
We are witnessing a surveillance free-for-all in which states and industry are essentially collaborating in the spread of technology that is causing immediate and regular harm to individuals worldwide, often across borders, harming individuals and organizations that are essential to democratic life, journalists, defenders, opposition figures, lawyers, and others.
In his report, Kaye cites numerous examples. In one case, Ethiopia's government allegedly spied on an Ethiopian-born man in the U.S. The technology infected his computer with malware marketed by a German and British company. The program recorded his emails, internet video calls, and keystrokes. The data was then sent back to servers in Ethiopia. In another case, Kaye says credible reporting suggests the Chinese government used facial recognition technology and surveillance cameras to look for ethnic Uyghurs based on their appearance. The government reportedly keeps records of their comings and goings for search and review. He says some of the technology was produced by private Chinese companies. Kaye says the technologies are spreading globally without control. He says the private surveillance industry operates in the shadows, developing and marketing the technologies in highly secretive settings. He notes that trade is driven by a thirst for profits. He warns the failure of states to impose constraints on the export or other transfer of targeted surveillance technology allows the illegitimate, dangerous trade to flourish.
There's wide recognition that digital surveillance, particularly when conducted in the absence of legal constraint and oversight, under cover of secret laws or policies, without disclosure of purchase or use, is a threat to freedom of expression.
Kaye is calling for an immediate moratorium on the global sale, transfer, and use of the tools of the private surveillance industry. He says he's not calling for a permanent ban or an end to all surveillance, but he says rigorous human rights safeguards must be put in place to assure digital surveillance tools are being used in legitimate ways before business in the technology is allowed to go ahead. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now, if we take a quick look back in time, it was on this date back in 1963 that U.S. President John F. Kennedy visited West Berlin, where he delivered his famous speech expressing solidarity with the city's residents, declaring, "Ich bin ein Berliner," or "I am a Berliner." In 1948, the Berlin Airlift began in earnest after the Soviet Union cut off land and water routes to the isolated western sector of Berlin. And in 1997, the first Harry Potter novel, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone by J.K. Rowling, was published in the UK, which was later rebranded Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And that's going to do it for me today. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and engineer, Rob McLean, thank you so much for joining us. Now for pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a wonderful Wednesday.